Well, good morning. It's so good to see you all here this morning. My name is Bill Altman, and if you are watching with us online, love to say welcome to you all as well. We know that people participate with our services online for many reasons, and one is that you're checking things out before you visit in person, and if that's you, we would just love to see you here sometime face-to-face. We're looking forward to that. We also know that this week there are tons of college kids moving to Evansville or returning to Evansville. Classes are starting this week, and so if you are here with your family or by yourself, we would also love to say welcome to you as well. Now, I want us to start out our time together this morning with a question, and this isn't just a kind of think about it kind of question. I want you to turn to a person who's near you and share, when you were 18, what did you think you would be doing at this stage in your life? Okay? What would be your occupation? Where would you live? That sort of thing. And if you're, say, 25 or younger, maybe you can just answer the question, where do I think I'm going to be in 20 years, in 2043? All right? So, go. All right. Well, let me just ask this. By show of hands, how many of you nailed it when you were 18? Okay. You got to be older than 22. You know, for most of us, with a few exceptions, it doesn't take long for the reality of our life to diverge from those early plans that we had when we were 18. Now, I haven't told too many people this, but when I was in high school, I thought I would become a mechanical engineer. And so I didn't have a college fund coming from my parents or grandparents. So at the suggestion of a friend, I got it into my mind that I would apply for and hopefully attend the Air Force Academy. And so the summer before my senior year, our family took a road trip out west for my parents to attend a conference. And we camped out and did a lot of sightseeing on the way. And on the return trip, one of our stops was in Colorado Springs for us to visit the Air Force Academy, where we had called ahead and arranged a tour. And so when we got back home and the school year started, I did everything that I needed to do to start applying. I passed the academic and the physical qualifications, and there was a whole lot involved in that. But before I jumped through all the hoops and had the opportunity to be considered, I changed direction drastically. And that's another story. But even that thing that I did and pursued for the next 10 years of my life, I'm standing very far from where I thought that would take me. Now, I want you to think about this because I don't think I'm alone in this one. Do you ever wonder about that other life? Do you ever wonder if you had made just a different decision at that crossroads moment, how things would have turned out? Or maybe the story of your life is not so much about a different decision you've made, but something that happened to you, something that you didn't choose, maybe something that was hard that at the time you said it, that just, it kind of delayed and changed my whole life plan. It was just a huge interruption. Now, I know I'm not the only one who thinks about this sort of thing because I've had dozens of conversations with people about just this. And I also know, in part, that we think about this because of all the movies that have been made that explore alternate timelines. And there's a ton of them, you think about it. Probably the classic one is It's a Wonderful Life, that explores what would have happened if George Bailey, played by Jimmy Stewart, if he had never been born, what would have the world been like? And in my generation, it was the Back to the Future movies or Groundhog Day. And two of my favorite movies fall into this category. One is Run, Lola, which is a German film that probably most of you have not seen. And the other one is The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which is a story that has Ben Stiller's character, who's living just a very bland kind of grayscale existence, except every now and then he kind of disappears into his imagination, where the colors suddenly become vivid and he imagines himself doing the bold or the funny or the courageous things that were very different from the way that he was living his real life. And I wonder if the reason we think about this sort of thing is because God has placed into these hearts of ours a desire to live a life that matters. How many of us when we were 18 said, you know what, I just want to exist. I want to get by for the next 60 years, not really have much of an influence in the world, and hope that nobody notices when I'm gone, right? None of us say that. We want our lives to make a difference. We want people to be better for having known us. We want to plant seeds in our children and in the lives of the next generation so that there is fruit that is being born long after we're gone. These past few weeks, we've been looking at the life of a man named Elijah. He was a prophet. He was a spokesperson of God to the people of Israel. And we've been asking, what can we learn from his life, specifically as it relates to finding our fit? And we talk about fit. What we're really describing is the way that God will take the unique way that he's created us, our personality, our history, the things that really tug on our hearts, all of those things, our gifts, our abilities, our experiences, and he connects that with a part of his mission. Our fit is the place where those things come together. And the story of Elijah that we've been following today kind of takes us to this, like it's the pinnacle, the mountaintop experience of his career as a prophet. It's a story of confrontation and courage, of good and evil. And God shows up in some really amazing and miraculous ways. It was really Elijah's mountaintop experience. As we walk through the events that are recorded in 1 Kings 18, here's the question I want you to hold on to, okay? What if our story, what if our real story with all the good things and the hard things, the things we planned for and the difficult things that surprised us out of left field, what if that story is not an accident? What if God has been at work through all of that and he's positioned us exactly where he wants us to be and is setting us up for our own mountaintop story? So hold on to that question here over the next couple of minutes and we'll return to it. So what's happened already in the story that we're going to be continuing today? There was this evil king named Ahab, and he was a bad guy. And his wife named Jezebel was also bad, if not worse. And they had led the people of Israel away from following the one true God, their God Yahweh, to chasing after the, sort of a collection of idols, of false gods, collectively known as Baal. And because of that, then God sends Elijah to the king to announce, because your hearts are far away from me, for the next few years there's going to be a drought. No rain is going to fall. And so when we begin chapter 18, this is where things are. It's still dry. It hasn't rained now into the third year, and the people are suffering. So here's where chapter 18 begins. After a long time, in the third year, the word of the Lord came to Elijah. Go and present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the land. So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab. And then we're told just how bad things have gotten. Jezebel is running around putting the prophets of God to death. People are just struggling even to find grass to feed their livestock. It's kind of life and death situation where people are at that point. And so this meeting is about to happen, and as far as Ahab is concerned, Elijah is the guy who's responsible for all of this. And so he says to him when they finally meet up, oh, it's you, you troubler of Israel. So continuing on in verse 18, Elijah says, I've not made trouble for Israel, but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's command and have followed after the Baals. Now summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel, and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. So Ahab sent word throughout Israel and assembled the people on Mount Carmel. Elijah went before the people and he said, how long will you waver between the two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him. But the people said nothing. Now, I think it's significant that Elijah suggested Mount Carmel for this showdown between Yahweh and Baal. For one, it rests kind of between Israel and Phoenicia. And the Phoenicians were the ones who came up with this whole worship of Baal. He was their god. And so this was kind of in that no man's land between the two nations. But even more significantly, the Phoenicians saw Mount Carmel as the sacred place where Baal lived. And so when Elijah suggested this, Ahab must have thought, okay, like we're going into this with a home field advantage. And so when everybody gathered, Elijah must have been heartbroken by what happened, because he laid it out before them and he said, this is the most important decision you could possibly make. Everything in your life rests on you getting this right. And he said, you're wavering between the two. And that word waver, actually, it means to stumble. It means to fall. It means to trip. And he's looking at the people and that's how they're living their lives. And his heart was for them to live a better way. And the people say nothing. So Elijah sees the people stumbling around. And on one hand, they're worshiping a false god who's not real, who has no power to influence their lives at all. In fact, Baal was known as one of the nature gods. He was a god over storms and rain and thunder. And over these last years of drought, this god was ineffective to do anything to bring rain. But on the other hand, they were kind of covering their bases. They would worship Baal one day, make a sacrifice to him, and then later in the week, they would go and sacrifice to Yahweh, except they weren't doing it on his terms. God always wants our whole heart, and he doesn't want to share us with anyone. So the people are broken, stumbling and falling, and Elijah wants them to choose a better way. And from this, I see that God may be pointing us toward our fit when we see something that's broken. Now, I had conversations with some of my friends from Crossroads, people that I look at their lives and see that they are serving in their sweet spot, that they have come a long way toward finding their fit. And to a person, they told me about a time when they saw something that was wrong with the world, and their heart was just moved toward taking one step toward solving that. One person said, I don't remember myself being anything other than this. It just kind of seems to be baked into my personality. But even when I was a little girl, I would walk into a room and I would scan the room. I'm looking for the kid who's sitting by themselves. And she said, people have said this to me all my life, that I always root for the underdog. And still today, she's serving and gets so much joy and friendship out of coming along those who are disadvantaged in this life. One guy said that God used some key men at an important point in his life, and it wasn't the world so much that was broken, it was himself, and he was living in a way that was very self-seeking, complete orientation toward his own needs. And in that process of God transforming him and changing him from that kind of a person to a person who was God-focused and family-focused and church-focused, God used those men, and now his heart is to help guys avoid the brokenness that he experienced at that point in his life. Another person who's involved with Potter's Wheel, one of our local partners that comes alongside families, especially families with children, and helps them in all kind of practical ways, she said, I first saw compassion lived out in the life of my dad. I saw it in his example. And she grew up in a kind of close to an agricultural area in a part of the country where there were a lot of migrant workers who would kind of cycle through every year. And she just saw the way her dad would reach out and love those people. Something awoke in her when she was 5, and she can still remember first and last name. I only wrote down Sally. I don't remember the last name, but Sally was the little girl who was from one of these families, and they were going to visit them, and she knew that there wasn't much coming her way for Christmas. And so as a 5-year-old, she brought her doll to give to Sally. And that just started something in her life. Most of the people that I just talked to described something similar. Usually that connection was made a little bit later in their lives. But I want you to think about how much gets done because someone looks around and sees something that's broken, something that's messed up, something that's not right. And as best as they can, with God's help, they start moving toward trying to find solutions to those problems, trying to take one step to maybe putting it back together. We have in our community foster parents who, because there are families that are broken temporarily, and there is a need for children to have stable and secure love for that season, step into that. Sometimes they'll look at the statistics and see how many children are on waiting lists and just say, that's wrong. Like, somebody needs to do something about that. And then they step in. We have people here that are a part of our community that when they come on the weekends, they serve coffee or they greet at the door or hand out donuts. And that's because the world is broken. And so many times people come into this space and they've been beat up by their week. And for someone to greet them with a smile or to provide coffee or a donut, it just communicates, you know what, this is a place where you matter. For some people, they've been given a miraculous ability to hang out with preschoolers. And so they are able to teach them, and they find that a delight and not a difficult work. Some people pour into our youth and to our students because they recognize that when a young person has not just a parent, but other adults who care about them and are teaching them and loving them, the chances go up dramatically that they will go out into the world with a secure faith that when difficulties come and trials and testing comes, their faith will withstand it. It won't become broken. In the next chapter, we're going to hear Elijah say, I have been very zealous for Yahweh, for the Lord. Do you see something that's broken? Pay attention to that, because God just might be working in your life through that. So this large crowd now is gathered together on the mountain. And by the way, think about Smokies more than Rockies. These are kind of like large rolling hills. And Elijah says, there's 450 of you prophets of Baal. And so let's do this. Let's get two bulls, and they will be prepared for sacrifice. You do that on your side, we'll do that. I'll do that on this side. And what I want you to do is prepare that animal for sacrifice, get the wood on the altar, get it all ready to go, place the meat on top, except don't light the altar yet. And I'll do the same thing on this side with the other bull. Verse 24, then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord, and the God who answers by fire, he is God. Now, think about how intimidating this must have been for Elijah, the confidence it would have taken for him to step into this situation. This is a life or death. It's laying everything on the line kind of deal. And just imagine the pressure that he would feel. We might, putting ourselves into his place, be tempted to think, like, this is too out there. It's kind of strange. It's too big. How do I relate this to my life? Well, I want you to remember something that Phil read from the book of James several weeks ago. Very simple line. It just says this: Elijah was a human being, even as we are. I think the way to make sense of this is to remember that Elijah has a backstory, that he has a history. Last week in chapter 17, we saw that God sent Elijah to a widow and her son, and miraculously made a way for them to continue to provide food for themselves during this drought. And then something happens in that story that it just feels random. It feels very out of place. The child dies. And then Elijah goes into the room where he's been laid out on the bed, and he prays to God several times for God to raise this boy. And God does that. He witnesses like a real life resurrection before him. And do you think that might have been a confidence booster for him to know that God is a God who hears our prayers and has the power to answer those things? So this was not Elijah's first assignment. His story didn't begin on Mount Carmel. There's a lot that came before that. And so what we can take from this part of the story is that God may be moving us toward our fit when we see him at work in our story. So here's the reality. We all have a story, right? You got a story. I have a story. Now, I was thinking about this over the last week when my parents celebrated their 80th birthday. Their birthdays are not too far apart. My dad just turned 80 earlier this month. My mom does a little bit later this fall. And we had a reception to kind of combine that with my dad's sort of semi-retirement. So people showed up from all the stages of their lives. It was really a beautiful moment. But that also meant that people showed up from many stages of my life. And so I was kind of, you know, wandering down my own personal memories. And one of the things that we did for my parents, our gift, my siblings and myself, is we got the box of old 8mm silent movies that my dad had taken over the years and had them digitized. And so when we had the opportunity to watch these, and we haven't seen them since, I mean, probably the early 80s would be the last time my dad got out the projector and we watched those. And so we were just struck by seeing the images of ourselves as children. And of course, my kids had never seen any of these things. One of those smart alecky ones said, I thought they would be black and white. So, some pictures from my early story. A little bit of a violent streak. You remember these things? These were horrible. Like you would climb up and slide for a millisecond and then bottom out on the floor. So yeah, at 4 or 5, I wanted to be a cowboy. And then this is the age where I decided I probably shouldn't be a cowboy. Don't put me on a horse. I just get all weird. I don't know what. I have no idea what was going on in my mind at this point. Yeah. Well, at that celebration were several families from the country of Zimbabwe and Africa. And this country has an important part of my own family story. The summer after I graduated from high school, our family had the chance to go there, and my dad to fill in for a missionary that had come home on furlough. And that resulted in my parents living there for 10 years. And those 3 months in 1986 changed my life in many, many, many ways. And one of them is I made the decision to not pursue the Air Force Academy and instead go to a Bible college and prepare to become what I thought would be my future, which was to be a missionary and probably in Africa, was my belief. So when my wife Missy and I met and we started to see things moving toward marriage, this dream that had been mine, she began to share in, and that dream became a shared dream. But instead of Africa, we moved to the south of Ukraine in 1994. And when we moved there, 2 things happened simultaneously. One is that we absolutely fell in love. We fell in love with the people, the language, the food, the place, the work we were doing. We just loved it. The second thing is that Missy's health tanked. The asthma and eczema that had been a part of her life, most of her life, and just mainly an inconvenience, became debilitating. And the result was that after 3 years, we returned back to the States, and I thought it was the death of a dream. Now, we've lived here in America since 1997. Our kids were not raised as missionary kids, and Paul Linge speaks way better Russian than I do. If you know Paul, he's on staff, and he and his wife, Emily, lived in Ukraine much longer than we were able to. For a long time, I held on to grief about that. I didn't understand why God would take us there, only to let my wife suffer and then us return home, leaving a part of our hearts forever in Crimea, Ukraine. Now, fast forward to past having children and living in New York City and in Charlotte, North Carolina, and lots of wonderful seasons and a few challenging ones. Missy goes back to school, becomes a licensed counselor, and new dreams begin to form. One is a dream that God put in her heart, a desire to help missionary families thrive by providing counseling when needed. And you have to know that in the past few years, God has opened up all kinds of crazy doors for her to be able to do that. And this week, honestly, just a couple of days ago, I was thinking about it, and this hit me, that maybe those dreams, maybe those dreams that God had put in my heart all those years ago was not about me. It wasn't about my identity and what I thought my life would become. Maybe what I felt was an act of abandonment was actually a gift to me and to Missy that put in her heart a desire to do what she's doing and built within her an empathy to be able to say to people who are living in cross-cultural situations, I understand what it's like to be going through a hard time there. Because, you know, there's some kinds of empathy that can only come to us through suffering. And so maybe what I felt was one of the hardest things that God ever put us through was actually his greatest act of kindness to us, because he was playing the long story. He was playing the long game. For Elijah, it was a resurrection and 1,000 acts of obedience that prepared him for Mount Carmel. As I was talking with my friends this week, there was another common feature to every story. One person said, just obey God with one thing and see what happens, and you'll find that he's going to take you on a ride. One guy said that his whole spiritual journey began by saying yes to one thing. It was a mission trip to Haiti. And he was not a part of Crossroads or any other church, but his family was, and he was here visiting with them and heard about this trip and went back out east where he was living and knew that he had to go, that this was what he was supposed to do. And so his family made sure it was okay for him to do so, and he bought a ticket. He caught a flight out of New York City that was delayed because of a huge snowstorm. So he was flying to a place he had never been to meet up with people he didn't know, to do a thing that he had never done before. And he said, this has been a pattern for me, that every movement of God in my life that has brought me the greatest joy, that's been the most meaningful and the most fruitful, has always been an incremental step where God put something in my heart and he gave me a choice, because he always gives us a choice. And when I stepped into that, that's where everything changed. And that's where the most beautiful things have happened in my life. And it always has begun with one step. So the rest of chapter 18 plays out. The prophets of Baal began to pray early in the day for fire to come down from heaven, and nothing happened. So they began to pray louder. They began to dance around, and they actually even take out knives and begin to cut their skin, just doing anything they can do to try to get the attention of their God. And at one point, Elijah calls out and says, maybe he's asleep. Or maybe he's relieving himself, or he's on a trip, he's traveling, and still nothing. But morning to night, they did this dance, and then these sad words. But no one answered. No one paid attention. Now it's Elijah's turn. So he sets up the altar that had fallen into disrepair, placed wood on it, placed the sacrifice on top, and then he asks several of the bystanders, I want you to take 4 large jars of water and empty them out on top of the altar. Now do it again. Now do it a third time. And now water is dripping down off that mead over and across the wood and the stones and across the ground into the trench that he had dug around the altar. Here's what happens next, verse 36. At the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, Lord, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and I have done all of these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so that these people will know that you, Lord, are God and that you are turning their hearts back again. Then the fire of the Lord fell, burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. And when the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. Now, moments earlier, when Elijah stood before that same crowd and gave his talk and said, choose one way or the other, gave his best speech, people were silent. They said nothing. But when God moved and when God acted, the people fell on their faces and said, the Lord is God. There's no dancing. There's no yelling. There's no slashing of his skin. Just quiet confidence that comes from 1,000 yeses and 1,000 answered prayers. Just a simple, quiet prayer. And the fire of the Lord fell. And so you know you have found your fit when God shows up. God shows up when he gives you the courage to walk across the street, to talk to a neighbor you've not met and you follow through with that. Or when he gives you the words to say to a coworker who's going through a divorce or some other kind of really challenging time in their life. When God opens doors that you could have never opened on your own. Or when he gives you a supernatural love for preschoolers that makes teaching them a delight. When God helps you see for the first time that what you thought was a defeat and a disappointment was part of getting you where you are today. And if that hard thing had not happened, you wouldn't be the man or the woman you are now. This makes me wonder if finding your fit is the best way to say what we're talking about. Because the truth is, God didn't ask Elijah to find his fit. He just asked him to obey. Just take one step, and I will take you toward your fit. Elijah gave God his heart. He described himself as a servant of the God Most High, and God led him step by step, probably small steps at first, and then little mountain by little mountain, and eventually to big mountains. And so I'm going to ask you to do just one thing today. I want to ask you, would you commit to just one step toward whatever mountain God might have in mind for you? I don't know what that step is. You probably don't know what that is either. We would love for you to register and come to the class next weekend, the Find Your Fit conversation. It's just about an hour, and it will just help you maybe determine what might be a place to start or what might be the next step in your journey. So one of my friends said this week, just dip your toe in the water. Don't make big promises to God or to yourself or to anyone else. Try something. If it doesn't fit, try something else. Just start with one act of saying yes. The second thing that I'll ask you to do is to just simply tell someone about it. Tell someone about this intention. I think sometimes things don't really solidify in our minds until we bring somebody else into it. And that just helps us to drive a stake into the dirt and say, okay, from this day, I'm making this commitment. And would you be with me on the journey? So that's it. Just commit to one step, which will reveal the next step, and will reveal the next step. And it's not always easy, but sometimes it is. And for most people, God doesn't ask them to change jobs or change homes or move to another country, but sometimes he does. And if that feels a little bit scary, that's okay. Because when God looks at you, he sees a beautiful before and after story in the making. Actually, he sees 1,000 little before and after stories in the making. Can I make you a promise? That if the story of your life from where you are today on into the future, if that story is defined by those markers, those places where you said yes to God and followed through in obedience, here's my promise. You may look back and still wonder what would have been if you hadn't said yes. But I'll tell you what, you will never long for any life other than the real life, the life that God has given you as he has walked with you step by step and mountain by mountain. Oh yeah, you're probably wondering about the rain, right? That's where this whole story started, with God came to Elijah and said, go to Ahab and tell him no more rain for the next few years. And then he came again and said, okay, time for the rain to fall. You can read about that in the last 5 verses of chapter 18. It's kind of an interesting end of the story, but it rained.